You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, Republicans on Capitol Hill have released their replacement plan for the Affordable Care Act. We'll learn what their new plan does and what it could mean for programs like Medicaid moving forward.
First, we live our life by clocks and alarms and deadlines, but most of us don't really understand how time works. Sometimes a minute feels like an hour, and other moments, hours fly by in what feels like seconds.
Our next guest set out to understand time as it functions in his own life as the father of twin boys and from a scientific perspective.
Alan Burdick joins us now. He's a staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker. He's the author of the book Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Well, how did you first get interested in figuring out exactly what's going on with time?
Well, a couple of things. My last book was about evolution and ecology, and it got me kind of thinking about these vast timescales of tens of thousands, millions of years, and the difficulty with just how hard it is to think of those scales because we, you know, live in a 90-year, 100-year window. And so it got me thinking about what time is really, not out there in a space-time kind of way, but in here, in us. And also, you know, like a lot of people, I had what I would call an antagonistic relationship to time. and I thought maybe if I studied, you know, if I studied it, I might get better at it.
In a way, was it kind of hard to separate out what time is scientifically? Because for the most part, it's the water that we swim in, and it seems like it's possible to stop noticing, at least maybe until we have kids or something like that.
Well, in a way, yeah. I mean, time. We talk about time all the time, but in terms of the perception of time, we're actually perceiving a number of different things. Time is an array of perceptions, from our understanding that the past is different from the present and the future, to understanding what's called temporal order, the order in which things happen, to understanding duration, you know, my ability to tell that 3 seconds is longer than 2 seconds without even counting it. These are all really distinct psychological phenomena, and they come online as we grow into them. You might have a 2-year-old kid who can speak perfectly well in the past and the present tense, but doesn't know the difference between before and after until they're 3 or even 4 years old.
So in that sense, did you find out that time is not necessarily that, I guess, feels like a biological imperative? It is because our bodies age, but do our minds have to catch up to that understanding of time that you're describing?
Well, I kind of began to think of time, at least in the psychological sense. I mean, we do really have kind of time hardwired into our cells. But the kind of psychological time that we experience, I began to think of as almost like a language that we really need in order to socialize with one another at all these different levels. And you know, kind of like a language, it doesn't really exist. You know, the perception of time doesn't really exist without us to perceive it. It's not an illusion, but, you know, we need it.
From a philosophical viewpoint, going in, what were the big questions you wanted to answer about time?
Well, I mean, I guess I wanted to know. I started out wanting to know what is it, and that was really the first question that I kind of posed to the psychologists and neuroscientists that I talked to, and they would all turn it around on me and say, "Well, what do you mean by time?" and then they parsed it out in all of these different ways. And as I kind of got deeper and deeper into these rabbit holes, I began to wonder about, like, you know, what exactly is the present that we experience, you know, the now, and how long is now exactly? When you start diving into the literature on time, you can really fall down some very deep holes.
So yeah, that question of now, because that's something we get hit over the head with quite a lot. We always hear how it's desirable to live in the now. The only moment of your life you can actually experience is now, but that now can sometimes feel kind of elusive. So what did you find out about what now is?
Well, I mean, and again, it's probably important to say we're not talking about, you know, physics or space-time, but what, you know, the perceptual now, the perceived now. And There was a time at the end of the 19th century when, you know, a group of psychologists was really actively involved in trying to measure how long now is in all these very kind of picayune ways. But William James kind of came along and said, look, you know, let's just say that the present isn't some point in time. It's what he's going to call the specious present. And it's, you know, maybe a second long. It's kind of long enough to contain, you know, a thought and its very short tail. You know, it's enough to notice that there's a sparrow flying across the yard. The way he defined the present is almost like the basic unit of psychological awareness, the basic unit of consciousness, in effect.
Well, what if you're a physicist and you approach it from that point of view? Then what do you say if I ask you, what is time?
Well, I mean, again, that's really not something that I dived into for these purposes because, you know, I felt like that has been pretty well discussed in ways that I still barely understand and that most of us have a hard time wrapping our minds around. But, you know, when we talk about time in us, we're talking about the perception of time, and we're talking about ultimately perception. You know, we're talking about the act of perception and how that works.
We're talking with Alan Burdick right now, staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker, and he's the author of Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. And you wanted to see what it was like to kind of lose your sense of time, and you went to the Arctic during the summer when there is no real night. What did that end up being like?
That was pretty wild. I mean, the reason I did that is because there's a very long established literature on the biology of time, and in our bodies, in our cells, in our organs, we have basically these 24-hour clocks that tick out a very regular rhythm that kind of run our physiology. And there have been all these interesting experiments done sending people into caves for weeks at a time to see how they respond to, you know, how do they perform in the absence of light. And I wanted to see what that was like, except I didn't really want to go to a cave. I wanted to go into constant daylight. And it was really surreal. You know, I'm accustomed to, you know, going to bed when it's dark and waking up when it's just getting light. But up there, you know, you go to bed when it's totally bright outside, and you wake up when it's totally bright outside, and it begins to feel like one very long, endless day in a way that's both wonderful and utterly disorienting.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I mean, did being a little unmoored, untethered from time as we know it, did it feel liberating, or did it feel like a curse? Maybe you needed time more than you thought.
Yeah, I did need time more than I thought. I mean, I was with a group of biologists in a camp that they have up there. There's like 100 of them. And people kind of fell into two categories. There were people who ignored their watches and they stayed awake as long as they wanted to, and they slept as long as they wanted to, and they worked and ate whenever they wanted to. And then there were people like me who felt like I need some kind of a regular rhythm to my day, and I'm going to go to bed at 10, you know, when my watch says 10 o'clock, even though all the visual cues suggest otherwise. And I needed something to hang on to.
And you also wanted to check out kind of what happens in extreme situations. We hear about if you're in an impending car crash, that time can slow down and these seconds can really drag before the moment of impact. How did you check out that angle?
Yeah, it's a hard, you know, it's a hard thing to investigate, obviously, because you don't want to put people in truly life-threatening situations. But maybe the closest we've come is a study that a neuroscientist named David Eagleman did a few years ago, in which he had subjects, it took them to a kind of an extreme amusement park and had them free fall from the top of a 100-foot tower into a net, and he'd set up a kind of a special chronometer on them to see, you know, if their sense of time slowed down during this stressful process. And I actually took part in it to see what it was like, and it really was kind of terrifying. and I, you know, I can say that time kind of did slow down a little bit. But, you know, what we kind of think is happening in those moments is that in moments of stress, memories are getting laid down basically in thicker layers and higher resolution. And in the moments afterward, the brain translates that extra resolution into more duration, into a moment seeming to take longer.
Oh, that's interesting. So you have, do you feel this in yourself, that you have this moment that's sort of seared into there about when you're dropping down to this net?
Well, in a funny way, it happened so quickly that it was almost, you know, by the time that I realized that I was in free fall, it was essentially over. Because that's part of it, too, is that our, you know, our conscious awareness of right now actually trails the physical experience by about a tenth of a second. And so, you know, what we think of as right now is a little bit behind the times.
And you also went into this as a new parent with twin boys. And flash forward 10 years later, you finished your book and your children are 10 years old. Did you get a sense on that kind of time, both for children and for yourself, and that sense of time speeding up for some people and slowing down for others?
Yeah, in a funny way, it's kind of a, I mean, for all the science that's in it, it's kind of a coming-of-age story in that, you know, I'm becoming a parent, I'm learning what it means to take on that responsibility, and I'm also watching my kids grow into, you know, the adult world of time, which is all these things, from knowing, you know, what it means when you say 8 o'clock on a clock, to knowing what, you know, we're going to leave 5 minutes from now means, to, you know, getting them to understand that we're going to do this, and then after that, this, and then this, and then this. And you know, those were conversations that I was having all the time with my kids without even thinking about it. And that became kind of the lens through which I started to see, you know, everything that I was reading about.
And Alan, as we wrap up, there's a lot of literature, there's songs, considering whether or not time is this cruel taskmaster that devours our lives, or whether it's an angle or like an angel that lets us get some distance from the things that hurt us. Where do you come down on that now?
I mean, I think it's both a curse and a blessing. You know, the curse is that there's not enough of it. But the blessing is that, you know, that we have it at all. and it, you know, it is integral to our lives as a social species. We couldn't be social without it.
Alan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was Alan Burdick, staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker, and he's the author of the new book, Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation.
Coming up, we'll learn about the GOP's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.